We took a break, but we didn't last night. Sorry. As Jim Duff told all of you, I was hosting a conference called Questions of Values, Ways of Response to the Islamist Challenge, with extraordinary people. Four women who are spokespeople for human rights. These conferences weren't about the geopolitical nature of the Islamist Challenge or Iraq or Afghanistan. This was about what the existential threat to our way of life is from fundamentalism, and what we as Canadians are prepared to do about it, and in fact, what we can do about it. And the stories of these women were extraordinary. What was extraordinary was the suffering that three of the four had undergone under Islamist regimes, and how they came west and rebuilt their lives and had the courage to defend what we in Canada like to talk about values, but defend the primordial value of freedom. And they do it with what Bobby Kennedy called the cardinal human virtue, courage. Bridget Gabriel, who was Lebanese Christian, scarred in an attack by Islamic fundamentalists in southern Lebanon, treated in Israel, brought back to health, summed it up by saying, "We cannot afford to lose our cherished freedoms to radicalism." And people got the message that moral relativism and saying that the other guys have a right to be wrong isn't good enough for Canadians if we really believe in our values. And it's not good enough if you're a union leader to pander to a Hezbollah crowd for union cards. And it's not good enough if you're a politician to pander to that same crowd for votes. Because values are transcendental. Either we believe it or we don't. As I constantly ask of people like Jack Layton, who want to talk to the people like the Taliban, what do you want to talk about if you're such a big promoter of values, whether they shoot you as a socialist or whether they behead you as a trade unionist? But perhaps, above all, the primordial litmus test of what we're ready to defend in our Canadian way of life is the Islamic fundamentalist challenge to women's rights. What do we negotiate away? The women should cover their faces and be hidden as a sign of separatedness? That they walk 5 feet behind men? That they're beheaded if they have adulterous affairs? Just where does it stop? Poignant moments of the conferences, and there were two, one downtown and one uptown, was the story of given by Nazanin Afshinjan, who's become an international human rights advocate. She just came back from an Amnesty International Day Against Death Penalty in Berlin and spoke at Cambridge University as well. And she has taken on the case of an 18-year-old girl named Nazanin Fatahi, who sits in an Iranian jail after having her death sentence commuted because she stabbed the man who raped her. Because there weren't four male witnesses, which is what you need to constitute rape under Sharia law, she was sentenced to death for shaming her family. And one thing Nazanin said should resonate across Canada. Not only must we believe in our values, but if you can do it, you must act. As she put it, si vous pouvez, vous devez. If you can, you do. And we'll be right back to go through the conference and a little more of Nazanin's work right after this. And we're back, as we've been doing all week. We're discussing human rights and the struggles for human rights and what we as Canadians have to do if we're going to legitimize being called a nation of values. And we reviewed yesterday's conference that the Institute of Public Affairs put on. And as I told you before the break, one of the, I won't call it a soundbite, but one of the slogans that was resonated throughout has been, si vous pouvez, vous devez, if you can, you must. And that was a line of our next guest, Nazanin Afshinjan, who's become an international human rights activist. And we have to say it, Nazanin, and ex-Miss World Canada. Thanks for coming on. I know you had a long flight out of Montreal.
Thank you for having me again.
The subtitle in one of the articles covering the conference was, "It's Time to Let Go of the Fear." You talked yesterday about the human level of your work, the people in Iran who are trying to reach out to you on your website, and the kind of questions and the kind of pleas that you're sent to, that are sent out to you. Talk to us about some of that.
A lot of them come from women, women my age or even older, who have gone through domestic violence, or they've been raped, or they have a lot of hidden secrets that they feel that they can't share with others, maybe because they'll feel shame in front of their friends and family, or even they might even get excommunicated. So for some reason, they trust me, and they're able to share with me. Maybe it's because of the distance and the internet and the fact that I can't see them and look in their eyes when they say this, but it's their way of release. And it's really heartbreaking because, you know, being on this side of the world and not being able to hold their hands or, you know, hold them while they cry, it's a bit overwhelming. But I mean, I do my best, and I try to divert them to the right people or give my advice, but obviously I'm not a counselor or psychologist, so I try not to take it too far without giving them some professional help.
It's interesting, during the 70s and 80s and the days of social action on behalf of political dissidents in the Soviet Union, the dissidents would get out what were called zamizdat, underground letters that were given to anybody, journalists, reporters, businessmen, crumpled pieces of paper. This is like electronic zamizdat coming out. Is there no fear that it can be traced back?
There is. I don't think so much for the average person. There are moral police and different people in Iran who control these things.
I think they're called in the Ministry of Vice or Virtue or something, or the Ministry of Virtue.
I'm not sure what it's called in English, but I do know that they keep a good track. It's kind of like the CIA of Iran. And I have to be careful when speaking with Nazanin's lawyer, because they might be taping her conversations, and obviously I don't want to be putting her in any jeopardy. So the conversations are very brief and to the point, and same with emails. I email her, when is a good time to call? So it's a dangerous position to be in. The fact that she's put herself in this position and helping this girl is very courageous, and if it wasn't for her and other people like her, then we couldn't do the work we do and help people like Nazanin.
Now, you've got a Nazanin fund that really is that really can and should be a fund for all prisoners of this regime, of course, the listeners who out there weren't at the conference yesterday. I want to repeat something, that the next issue of Barricades, which is the journal of the Institute, the cover story will be a world exclusive called The Prison Diaries of Akbar Mohammadi, who was a student dissident leader who died 2 months ago. And he was tortured by the same man who killed Montreal photojournalist Zarek Hazemi. Part of his torture was having his mouth glued shut, but not before he wrote this diary, Ideas and Lashes. And with so many people out there needing help in Iran. Iran is an interesting case. You have a government, a fundamentalist government, yet without argument, the most Western-oriented civilian population. What more can be done in the Nazanin Fund? And how much resources do you need? If you had one message to tell Eastern Canada today?
Well, the fund that we do have set up specifically for the Save Nazanin case, it's on helpnazanin.com, and we're trying to, you know, raise money so that we can continue to make phone calls to Iran, continue to send, let's just say, clothes to her because she's cold and in the prison, and just the thousands of dollars that have been spent on printing the petition. It costs 1 cent per person. And when I delivered the petition at the UN, at that time there was 170,000 signatures, so that's $1,700 out of our own pockets. And these bills add up. Phone bills to Iran are not cheap. So, I mean, they add up. So the fund that's on the site, we have specifically for the Nazanin Fund, but there's a million other organizations that are in need of helping those that are, you know, political prisoners in Iran, or obviously there's poverty. There's a lot of
them. But, you know, sometimes we get caught up in the general ideas and we lose sight of the human beings. So here's a human being that needs the help.
Yes. Well, she's specifically, in her case, she comes from an extremely poor family. When I was talking to her lawyer last, she said that when the parents came into the courtroom, it was real embarrassing because, you know, they're wearing slippers, they've got rags on, and they can barely even catch, like, afford to take the bus to the prison to visit their own daughters. And the father's been sick for a decade with many illnesses. The mother goes and tries to support the six or seven siblings by doing house cleaning work. So they're in desperate need. And when we speak to Nazanin's mother, she has to use her neighbor's phone because obviously they don't have a phone. They don't have a car. They don't have anything. So Nazanin said it in her own prison cell. She said, outside of these prison walls is still a prison for me. And I think she means that in more ways than one.
Well, as long as there are vocal advocates like you out there, there's hope for Nazanin's, not only Nazanin Fateya, but all the Nazanins in all the oppressed regimes. And this is our questions of values as Canadians, and this is our worth. Nazanin Afshinjan, we thank you for your work, and we thank you for your commitment.
Thank you very much for having me. And as you said yourself, if you can, you must.
That's your quote. Thank you again, Nazanin.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Montreal, will be right back. And you can email us after the show with your comments at info@iapm.ca. You know, this week was started with October 23rd, 50th anniversary of the Hungarian uprising. And we've devoted the week to people under oppression and their courage and response to that oppression. And we've had testimony and witness and memory from people who were in Budapest, in Lebanon, in Egypt, in Iran, and survived. We go to another part of the world, though, right now. From 1976 to 1983, a brutal military dictatorship ruled Argentina. Tens of thousands of people disappeared, never to be heard from again. It was thought that perhaps this regime and this way of oppression had gone by the boards in Argentina until very recently. When the trial of Miguel Echecolás, who was the police commissioner in Buenos Aires during the right-wing military dictatorship, reached a very dramatic point with the testimony of Jorge Julio López, a retired construction worker who was a former political prisoner. He was tortured. He has since vanished. And there are fears that maybe the right wing is rising with a new form of oppression. And it's our special privilege tonight to have with us Noga Tarnopolsky from Jerusalem. She's an acclaimed international journalist. She's lived in and written in five countries. Her work has been seen from everything from the New York Times to the New Yorker. And she herself lost members of her family to that regime. Noga, thank you very much for staying on, for staying up so late, even though you're a friend and advisor to the Institute. This is above and beyond the call of duty. How are you?
I'm up late. How are you?
Well, it sounds like you're partying. I'm not going to feel sympathy in a moment.
Well, I'm okay.
Noga, you just returned from a month-long visit to Argentina.
5 weeks, yeah.
What is this new stories, and it's made the New York Times? What is it about the López disappearance that has sparked this? Are there more than López? Is the story bigger than that?
The story may be bigger than that. The story is very complicated and very awful. Basically, Julio López left his house on September 18th, and no one's heard from him since. And one of the problems is that the fear and the suspicion is that it's sort of renegade, or maybe not that renegade, members of police or parapolice forces who are after the guy. And so it's unclear if the police, who are the only people anyone can turn to, can help find him. One of the terrible things that his disappearance has caused is really, I would say, feelings of terror among other people who were disappeared, who were tortured, among the few survivors of that period.
Including the witnesses at the trials.
Well, specifically, I'm talking about people who I'm friendly with who either have been witnesses or were potential witnesses in similar cases, often in even worse cases than that of Miguel Echecolás, who are simply petrified. It's difficult to describe the damage and the psychic fear caused by something like this in people who've already been through it.
Noga, we'll be right back with you. They're waving at me from the control booth, and you know what that means. We've got to pay some bills.
Okay.
Hang in there. We'll be right back. Mm-hmm. Well, all week long since Monday's show where we celebrated the 50th anniversary of the Hungarian Uprising, we've been talking about people under oppression and what each of us as individuals have an obligation to do. And it's our privilege to be joined right now by Noga Tarnopolsky, an internationally renowned journalist, just back from Argentina, where the possibility of the death squads is rearing its head again. Noga, this case of Jorge Julio Lopez, is there any intimations that his disappearance or organized or not disappearance, that the government is somehow involved again?
That's a very, very difficult question to answer because it's unclear what... I feel almost idiotic saying this, but it's unclear what we consider or what constitutes the government in Argentina. Have a situation now... Sorry?
No, I wanted you to explain to our listeners what that means. I think there's an impression in Canada that the only thing they know about Argentina is they've got a great soccer team.
That's right, they do, and great beef, but... There are very possibly rogue police forces. It's not clear under whose control they might be who are doing these kinds of things. The Julio Lopez case is by far the most terrifying and the worst, but there have been other cases that have gotten a lot less publicity because there's increasing censorship in Argentina and also because the other cases took place in more remote provinces. This happened flat smack in the center of the capital, and it was... had to do with a witness in a very high-profile case. But what you have right now in Argentina is a government that is somewhere on the democratic scale, but is not fully a democracy the way Canadians might think of it.
Well, we're not quite we're not quite sure what the Canadian parliamentary system, as opposed to our prime minister, but the system rates on that scale, but that's another story.
Yeah, and it's a different scale. In Argentina, there are... elections, but there are not democratic institutions of state. So it's unclear, for example, who might be behind a kidnapping like this, but it is absolutely amply evident that there's no one who can investigate it.
So this is a situation that bears watching and bears scrutiny for the next little while, and as the New York Times showed a very dramatic picture of Mr. Lopez at the very same police station we've been tortured 30 years ago...
Right before vanishing.
It's important to see where the litmus tests go. Noga, thanks for staying up so late. Have a good night or have a good party, whatever's happening behind there. And we'll be talking to you soon again.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Montreal, I'll be right back. Well, all week we've been talking about freedom and responsibility. And every night the lines have been lit up, but the guests have been so compelling. We've had to deal with them, and the guests have been from all over the world. And tonight is no exception. The lines are lit up, and we're going to try to loosen the load a bit on Chris Smith, our master controller in Master Control. Sharon, good evening.
Hi, Beryl. How are you doing?
Doing okay.
I wanted to congratulate you on that phenomenal conference that I attended yesterday. It was riveting. I had mixed feelings. And again,
what were your mixed feelings?
Well, having to hear again the oppression and man's inhumanity to man. Somehow we never seem to learn. But what you did was you have brought together Christians, Muslims, Jews, Arabs, together more than any other community organization. And
let's not leave out the atheists. They're people, too.
Well, whoever. They all came. And it was phenomenal. It was a packed house, and it needs to happen again. But I have one question.
What message? What message stuck in your heart? What was the... I quoted the poet, the Greek poet Aeschylus, pain which falls drop by drop upon the heart until through the awful grace of God we attain wisdom. What wisdom hit you? What pain hit you?
Well, what pain certainly hit me was the horrific case talked about both personally and through the people they were advocating, for example, Nazarene and Miss Canada, who we need to help to get those kids out of jail. They were the victims, and they're being punished. And my question relates to that, perhaps, and that is, we wouldn't accept priests preaching anti-Semitic garbage. We would do something. These mosques are on Canadian soil. Is there nothing we can do for those that continue to preach hatred against their own kind, against Christians, against Jews, to close them?
Well, the problem is that, as Churchill said, we cannot mirror what we seek to destroy. If we're sending the best of our young people abroad to defeat theocratic tyranny in the name of freedom, in the name of free speech, short of someone saying specifically, go out and kill this person, go out and kill this group. Once you start limiting speech, and it doesn't matter what that speech is, even if it's something as egregious as Holocaust denial, the slippery slope is that you eventually continue through the slow abridgment of every freedom. But that's the responsibility of being free. You know, George Bernard Shaw said, liberty demands responsibility. That's why so many dread it. So at the same time that we're aggravated, and I understand your frustration, I understand that these are bad people who are calling for these horrible things, but unless they specifically incite to violence...
But that's what they are doing.
Well, that's the point. You know, when there is an incitement to violence, and when it can be recorded and given to the proper authorities, there are sufficient laws on the books. We can't stretch incitement to mean this lunatic is saying the Holocaust never happened. That lunatic is saying that Jews and Christians are pigs and monkeys. Unless they specifically say something, if we limit speech, we are defeating our own purpose. That's the sad truth of it, as frustrating as it is. But it calls for a higher level of moral courage. It calls for a courage that is greater than merely going out and prosecuting the people who perpetrate hate. It calls for an internal moral courage, not of a tolerance of the intolerant, by no means, but of a moral courage that says, by your own word shall you be known, and by your own hate shall you be destroyed.
So where were some of the clerics, the moderate clerics yesterday, to help their own people?
I can't make a statement on that. The conference was open to the public. There were many specific invitations to clerics, to political people of all stripes. You were there. You saw who was there probably better than I, because I wasn't,
right.
You know, I didn't
fabulous.
See a lot of people in the audience. And it is... I think your question has its own answer, and our society will have to deal with it. And if I can just remind you of what Bridget Gabriel had to say, when we come to the West, we come for freedom, not to be merchants. And part of that freedom is that everybody who comes here should not think, multicultural policies or not, should not think that they have a right to impose their parochial particularities on our celebration of our common humanity. And when we learn that, we will be a mature nation. Sharon, I have to thank you very much. They're killing me again to pay bills.
Thanks again.
So here we go. We're going to pay some more bills. We'll be right back, Montreal. And as we wind down this week of looking at freedom, oppression, and the responsibilities of liberal countries, we're going to try to take some pressure off the calls. The lines have been lit all week. And let's go to Carol. Carol, good evening.
Good evening, Beryl. Before I go with my subject, I just want to give praise to the one that answers the phone. He's very nice. I want to thank him for his gentleness.
That's Chris Smith, master operator, master producer. I keep telling people that here all the time.
Yeah, very nice. Nice voice, good patience.
Kudos, Chris Smith. Oh, you've made him blush, Carol. He's pulling his hat down over his face. He's blushing.
Well, it doesn't show, but I'm shy too on the radio, and I'm blushing too. Usually nobody sees me. I know there's a bunch of a pair of ears who hear us. So, my subject tonight is concerning Afghanistan. The more I analyze the whole thing, even if we're talking about this, because I've heard things last night. I wanted to talk, but there were so many people that I was I stood on the line till the very end.
It's been crazy all week.
Yeah, but I listened to what you were saying, and I listened to also I just want to brush off.
Good crazy, by the way. Keep calling in, but the past 3-4 weeks, our lines have been lit.
Yeah, well, that's a good sign. It's a very good sign. It means that it's success. What they were saying about Afghanistan, and there was this woman who say the kids who are starving in Afghanistan and
yes.
everything. Now, okay, we're talking about the citizens, but you know what, Beryl? I don't trust neither one of them.
Neither one of...
You don't know who's on the good side.
Neither one of whom? I'm sorry, I lost you there.
I don't trust those guys, those citizens in Afghanistan.
Well,
because you don't know on which side they might be. They might be for the Taliban, and they pretend that they're not, you know, just to get more international aid so they can feed their sons. And then after their sons grow up and they mistreat the little girls there.
Well, look, I think it's important to understand, and sometimes this gets lost in the media. Mm. The Afghanistan mission has been a remarkable success. And it's a completely different situation than Iraq. In Afghanistan, you have a remarkably sophisticated group of men in power. Western trained. We've had Ambassador Omar Samad of Afghanistan on several times on the show. 80% of the country has electricity, hospitals that work, schools that work. Almost all women are going to school as opposed to 30%. They're what 30%? 5% of the Taliban. The problems stem from Kandahar province, which is the province on the Pakistani border where Pakistan is giving aid to the Taliban. In other words, you have a country, Carol, that was controlled by this retrograde group.
Yeah, not only
And now they're left in one province. So, you know, we've got to give the benefit of the doubt. This mission is a success. The government in Afghanistan is not like Iraq. It's not, you don't have internecine murder and killing. You have a very sophisticated democracy, and we have to make it stronger. Carol, I'm pressed against the clock. I thank you for your call.
Bye-bye.
Montreal, this has been a grueling week for me, and both emotionally and physically, and I want to leave you with one thought. If there is anything that I've learned from this week, it's that the solution is not love in the way that the songwriters talk about it, but the kind of transcendental feeling where we need to understand that each person's soul is our soul. And we can't breathe if that soul suffers. We're only 46 short years away from a young American president standing up and saying, each man's pain diminishes me. And that's what we have to remember as Canadians. That if there is one element, as the rabbi said last night, Rabbi Reuben Pupko, who I've done demonstrations on Darfur with, if there is one element in religion that is valuable, one element in the revolution of monotheism that is valuable, it is that if we all believe that we are created in the image of God, not physically, but in our souls, then we are all responsible one for the other. And it is with that message that we go onward. And it is that message that we take into the vanguard of the fight. Chris Smith, as always, many thanks. Montreal, Canada. Good night. See you on Monday.